So Yuande Omosoto, thank you so much for joining us on the Tuesday afternoon program. I am so happy to have you here. And I should say that we met a little over a week ago.
Yes, yes.
You were a resident at OMI.
Yeah.
And you were part of an international writers reading.
Yes.
Which was an extraordinary event.
Oh, thank
and
you.
I was thrilled to get to meet you, and I'm glad you're making yourself available.
Thank
for the
you.
Over.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here. I mean, it's great to thank you for asking for me to be on your show. I'm excited.
Thank you. So you were born in Barbados, but grew up in Nigeria, and then moved to Cape Town.
Yeah.
Currently live in Johannesburg.
Yeah.
I'm curious about your family. I know you have two older brothers.
Yes.
A younger sister who's a filmmaker.
And
a father who's a writer.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
So I have two older, there are three of us. So I have two older brothers, and it's me. I'm the younger sister.
Ah, okay.
And my father's a writer. My oldest brother is a filmmaker, and my other brother's a very intelligent person. He has the PhD in things I can't explain or describe. We call him the genius of the family.
So I'm curious about the family and growing up. Were you close to your siblings?
Yes. Yeah, we were close. And also my mom. My mom passed away, but she was an urban designer. An urban designer.
Oh, urban designer. Thank
you. Yeah. So maybe it's also what happens sometimes with when you travel. When you move, when families move, but we were close, which isn't to say that, you know, they weren't. I think I annoyed my brothers occasionally. I can't imagine why. But, so there's the normal family stuff, but I think particularly the move to South Africa, the family became really important.
Mm-hmm.
We moved to South Africa in 1992. I was 12. You know, we were at these ages, and kind of cleaving to one another became important, and so a closeness definitely took place there.
So how old were you when you were in Nigeria?
I grew up in Nigeria, really, because I was born in Barbados, but very soon, I was probably a year even, we moved back to Nigeria. I grew up in a town called Ile-Ife. It was a university town. My dad taught there, my mother worked there, and lived there till 91, and then we moved to South Africa, pretty much at the start of 92, we were settling into South Africa, to Cape Town.
It sounds to me like your parents were supportive of you as a creative person. Did they nurture? Well, I guess I'm curious about when you started to think of yourself as a writer, because you first graduated with a degree in architecture.
Yes.
And you are a practicing architect, right?
Yes.
So did your family support that? And your mother, you just revealed, was an urban designer. She must have been wonderful for you to have that language
connection.
Together.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it sort of happened. So in terms of creativity and reading and that whole world, that was always there.
And did your parents read to you as a child?
Definitely. Uh-huh. My mother in particular, my earliest memories are my mother reading to my brothers and I. My dad would read to us. And they'd read to us from a kind of a range of things.
Do you have a favorite book as a child? Do you remember something?
Yes, my mother used to read Eliot's poems, but like the cats.
Oh, yes, right.
With all the voices, and, you know, and so I can hear her still doing the voices of this whole array of cats. My dad would read to us in Yoruba. My dad is Yoruba, so he'd read Fagunwa stories, which is he's a really important Nigerian writer, Yoruba writer, of folk tales in a way. He would read to us from that. He'd read to us from the Yoruba Bible. You know, my dad was a language scholar, so he studied Arabic, he studied French, he spoke Yoruba, he spoke English. So,
goodness.
And as a writer himself, you kind of grew up in a house a bit like this room we're in, you know, with books everywhere, and poets will pass through and playwrights will pass through. And so it wasn't even that, I mean, now I know they nurtured it, but then it was just kind of, this is normal. Do you know what I mean? Which is, I mean, now with hindsight, I'm deeply appreciative. But at the time, this was just the water we were swimming in.
Did you go to friends' houses that didn't have as many books and think, ooh, what's going on?
What's wrong with this house?
What's missing here?
Because we were on a campus, we were friends with other professors and lecturers. And so it was also a very interesting childhood. Very small little place, quite protected in Nigeria at the time. And kind of a bubble, which has its pros and cons, but one of the beauties of it was a very kind of protected, quite literary, intellectual sort of community that we grew up in and around. So So we were always making things. We were building things. We were writing things. We were performing plays. We were playing the piano. We were, you know, people played the recorder. And it was that kind of childhood. Quite idyllic in a way. And maybe I do suffer from some nostalgia. I'll confess.
So I want to quote you from another interview you did.
Okay.
You said that regardless of how many years I've lived in South Africa, I think of myself as a product of three nations, Barbados, Nigeria, and South Africa. Nigeria forms a very strong part of my sense of myself, my identity. So I just mentioned a book to you that I just started reading by Andre Assaman called False Papers. Yeah. And it's a memoir. And he said something that made me think of you.
Okay.
Which was that although he was born in Alexandria, Egypt, they were forced to move as Jews in the 50s. And he lived there and got educated in many different cultures.
Okay.
Ended up in the Upper West Side of New York. But he has said that Alexandria has always haunted him.
Mm.
And using the word haunted.
Yeah. It's a perfect word.
Okay, so I want to see if that has any applicability to your life, and if so, where, and how does that feel to you?
Yeah, I like that word, and I mean, I could even dare to sort of qualify it a bit, because sometimes, like, haunt, you can be haunted by something, and there's a sense of foreboding about it, but there's also, it can be delicious as well. Do you know what I mean?
Well, it can be mystical.
Exactly,
well as,
and I definitely, I feel that. The ways I feel that are in a number of forms. One of them that's the most haunting is language, because language is also really important to me.
Mm-hmm.
My father's language is Yoruba. My mother, as a Barbadian woman, was English speaking. We spoke English in the house. And
so you grew up with English as your first language?
I grew up with English as my first language. Mm. And not only that, in certain spaces in Nigeria at the time, unfortunately, in schools, speaking English was a sign of status. So children were often kind of not allowed to speak their home languages or their native languages. Yeah. So in that way, I often feel a little handicapped in the sense that I don't have a language that I should. And I've written about language.
So that has a ghost quality to it.
It does, because I feel it's there, but it's not. Yes. And I've gone back as an adult to learn the language. I speak with my dad in it. But I'm speaking in a ghost language. It's not mine, but it should be.
So that's a very important component into establishing and sustaining one's identity.
Yeah.
So continuing with that interview, you said, identity is complex. I love being a Nigerian. I love belonging to that identity, even if my belonging is complex, due to my multiple identities and migratory life experience. That's how you feel? Yeah,
totally. I mean, I think identity is complex. I think one of the unfortunate things, identity is almost like this thing that we need but don't.
Well, it's not finite.
It's never finite. Evolving, but we do want to make it finite. You know, we want to. We have forms with boxes. We want to know what's your
somewhere.
Thing. We want to belong somewhere.
Yeah. But and also we want a tribe to belong with us.
So we want that belonging, but we also want our uniqueness.
Of course.
And then I'm also talking on the level of administration and organizing society. So from out in.
Right.
As the way, one of the ways we organize, or that organization happens, is category, you know, and this is the part of it that's problematic. So we need the category because we need to be able to put that there and put that over there.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't mean anything.
Well, we also need to reflect back on ourselves.
Yeah.
Right.
And
in some ways, that's both language and image, but that's the resource that we need to move out of.
Yeah.
Not always necessarily, but
well, have the
sometimes.
Door open. I mean, be able to move in and out.
Right.
So for me, that's the complexity of identity. I mean, it was interesting. There's another resident here who's also a writer. She's Nigerian. And we were having a conversation. And we were talking. And she suddenly looked at me and said, oh, are you counting yourself as Nigerian? And I mean, and I loved the question because she just had to check whether in this context I would count myself as a Nigerian. And I count myself as all three all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I understand that people don't always see me as that.
Sure.
Depending on the context, the environment, somebody would say, no, you know, you're not, or you're not. And they would have their reasons why, you know.
So thinking about finding a voice, I was very curious to discover your first book, Bomboy.
Yes.
That you wrote the narrative as a young boy.
Yeah, yeah.
So was that a conscious decision? Did it happen intuitively? Tell me about that. And then What was the challenges of writing in the voice of the other gender?
Yes, yes. Well, the big joke with Bomb Boy is I was writing it for a while, and then I was doing an MA at the time, a master's. So I worked as an architect, went back and did this MA, and that's my thesis was the book. So while I was working on the book, a teacher came, and my supervisor came, and he had a session with me. He was a visiting lecturer. And the first thing he said to me was, okay, I've read a few pages of your manuscript. And he said, don't worry, you've got the voice of the boy totally fine. And I remember when he said, don't worry, I thought, oh my God, I hadn't even thought to worry. I mean, he was introducing me to a concern I hadn't thought about. And I think, so it was intuitive, it was the story. I didn't worry too much. And I think this is important. I mean, obviously we're always talking about cultural appropriation and people writing the other. And
well, and having permission to now socially.
Having permission to, you know, I think, and I tread carefully, and this is a complex conversation with many facets, but I do, while I reserve the right to balk sometimes at people who take that, exercise the right to write the other, I also think it's a sad day when we say you're a creative person, but you can't go down that path.
Right.
You're a creative person, but you cannot go down that route. I mean, that doesn't sound like what creativity should be. So saying don't do those things doesn't seem the answer. At the same time, if you do them and it's problematic, and that's a wide and general word,
right.
Be prepared for.
Right. Are you following the controversy of the Emmett Till painting at the Whitney?
I've read quite a few. I mean, I won't say I'm au fait with every single article, but
you know about it.
I know about it.
So that kind of ties into what you're saying.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I've struggled with this too, because I completely understand the black artists that are saying this is highly inappropriate for a white woman to do a painting of such an important and painful chapter in our lives.
Yeah.
And yet I also feel, as an artist, oh, wait a minute.
Yeah.
I'm an artist. Yeah. I should have the freedom, the creative freedom, to do the work that moves me or that I need to explore.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
You know, it's conflicted for me. I agree. There's something about, and there are many ways to express it. There's this idea of, you need to make room, right? So as a white artist, as you actually need to make room, and maybe it's okay to leave certain things alone, because we're in a time where there's a recalibration that's required. And so you've occupied big space already. Now you're occupying this other space, and it's painful space, and it's delicate.
Right.
So I think that's important. And so I hear those people who are saying, whoa, you've really touched something. At the same time, I can't quite subscribe to something that says you shouldn't have. I think what's important is she did it. Do you know what I mean? It's done. So it's done. Do you want a rule now saying never do it again? No, I don't think so. But what I loved in the one I read was it felt like there was discussion. And that she and her response, at least up to this point, I haven't read, but I felt like her response was intelligent, because I didn't get the sense she was defensive.
I agree with
that.
Maybe
I'm wrong. No. I mean, I felt like she was like, okay, talk to me. Do you know what I mean? Which is what you want. And that almost feels more important than saying never do it. If you do it, be prepared to sit and listen then. And because it did come from somewhere, so she responded to an impulse, and that's creativity, right?
And I guess you're making me think too that making the painting is also different than exhibiting the painting.
That's another.
She did have a choice.
Yeah.
After she felt whatever she needed to make it.
Yeah.
But maybe she could have also withheld it if it was tender ground and inappropriate in some way.
Yeah.
But so we are learning. But I agree with you that her response seems to be full of integrity.
Yeah.
And she's being very careful and sensitive.
Yeah. Which is not always the case. Because I think oftentimes people are.
I mean, really, let's be blunt.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So let's go back a second, because I'm very curious about studying architecture. I can see now, with your mom being an urban planner and designer, of course, that would open some doors to you. But what about the shift away from architecture to writing?
Yeah. It was, and it really was.
When was this? So you're in college.
But I was writing from when I was really young, and always wanted to be a writer.
And so you knew you had talent and desire.
I don't know if I knew I had talent. I had desire, and I don't know that I didn't realize how much talent mattered as well. But I just
well, did
desire.
Your father see talent in
he
you?
He would, and he. I mean, my dad, to his credit, was very critical. You know, I remember him taking his pen to my things his red pen, and you know, teacher. And my dad is, I always say, he makes a great father because he makes a great teacher. I mean, he was really a teacher to us. And so I knew I wanted to pursue it.
Mm-hmm.
And when I finished school, I thought, okay, this is it. If I want to write, I'm going to write in English. I ought to study English. I told my dad, and he was like, you know, this is really not a good idea. You know, which is interesting.
So what did he want you? What was his suggestion?
He wasn't telling me what to do, but he just said, Yoande, I want you to... He kind of came at me with, you're a woman. I don't think you could get a decent job if you study English.
So his first worry was security for you.
Security for me.
He knew you were going to be independent.
Yeah.
You were not going to rely on someone else.
That was precisely his thing. Like, I don't want you relying on a man. You need to just get... And so he said, anything else, just something that has a career. My teachers looked at my marks and they thought, you know, there's a bit of math. But there was creativity. So they said... I said, how about something kind of technical but creative? And they said architecture. I wasn't chuffed. I wasn't pleased.
Mm.
But I did a bit of research and I thought, okay, I'll try it. You know.
And were you interested in residential architecture? Or is it?
Not necessarily. I was... Firstly, I didn't fully know what this thing was. I'd never thought about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I applied to the University of Cape Town and I got a position there to study it. And I went with a curiosity. I kind of remember because you had to write a kind of a motivational essay for why you wanted to be there. And I remember saying, I don't really know a lot about this. I haven't spent my childhood wanting to be an architect, you know. Mm. And so I'm coming in curious to learn what it is to put buildings together. And I just researched and read as much as I could and had, you know, 6 years of studying that were not always fun, but I got through it. And I went back and did a master's after many years of working as an architect, about 5 or 6 years.
So your work as an architect in what part of the field?
We ended up working. My first job was working for an urban designer and an architect, kind of in-house company, and we did what we call low cost housing or social housing.
Mm-hmm.
He did mainly social housing. We did different complexes and blocks in Cape Town.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked for them for a while. We also did other houses, usually a residential, it ended up. And then I took quite a departure and worked for kind of huge property development company as their, what they call the design manager, working. And they built hotels, shopping malls. Mm. You know, it was really the bad people. Pure kind of corporate, but I had an amazing boss, and I worked in an amazing environment and learned a lot, and I felt like, okay, this is a world I would never otherwise have ever interacted with.
Right.
So I just lapped it up, and I was there for about 5 years, and it was there that I decided, okay, like, what are you really doing?
Mm-hmm.
And I got my head around going back to study, and I did my master's part time while working.
Mm-hmm. So you knew it was going to be writing.
Yeah.
Did you feel it was fiction, nonfiction?
Yeah,
did
fiction.
You know,
I always thought it was fiction.
Always fiction?
Yeah, and I always thought it was novel. I find short stories very hard. I love them when I find them hard.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to go back to the quote again, or this wonderful interview. This is from the Short Story Day Africa.
Okay.
So it was a wonderful interview you did.
Thank you.
I write thinking, in some ways, we're not all as different as we'd like to believe. I think part of the important work of life is to get connected, be connected, see ourselves and others. You also said, while I'm not specifically attracted to writing what I don't know, I do seek to write what preoccupies me. And with your first book, Bomb Boy, the story came out of a preoccupation with solitude.
Mm.
Now, first of all, I have to just pause on this word solitude as an artist. We spend a lot of time in solitude.
Yeah.
And that really is sort of the nest of creativity for most people, isn't it?
Yeah, I agree.
So in the nest of solitude, what were the challenges for you initially? Thinking, okay, I'm leaving architecture.
Yeah.
I'm going to dedicate my life to writing.
Mm.
You're finding yourself alone.
Yeah.
What came up?
You know, I mean, maybe I'm lucky. I love solitude. I you know, and I know not a lot of people do. And I sometimes feel a bit bad about that, like I ought to.
Really?
Yeah, because, I mean, I love people as well. It's not like I think, I want to get away from human beings.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm with people, I'm enjoying it, these interactions, it's enriching. But if something happened and I couldn't be around people for a while, I don't know that I'd miss it. That's
what
I mean.
Well, you're on a residency.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is the whole idea, is really to savor the solitude.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's something I relish, in fact. Mm-hmm. And I for me, definitely, it's... It is the seat of a lot of my creativity. I think there's a way in which solitude is precious, because I think there are many people who need it and require it. Solitude allows for a certain kind of thought and depth,
mm-hmm.
and don't have access to that, whether it's because of they don't have the space for it, they don't have the time. Solitude can be expensive, you know, in a strange way. So I value my solitude really deeply.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So in your first book, Bomb Boy, mm-hmm. you got a lot of attention and awards. I mean, it was very successful for
you, right?
So how did that affect you?
I was surprised. The thing with the first book is no one's waiting. You know, no one's waiting for it. You don't know what you're doing. You don't know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I was very sort of, I'm going to write a book, and it's going to be a book when I'm done, and I'm going to send it. It's a novel. I'm going to send it out. I want to get into this publishing world. I want to start.
How many publishers did you send it to?
I know this is very unusual, but the first person I sent it to was a publishing house called Mujaji Books, and they were the publishers. I was told about them. In South Africa, it's kind of great because it's a smaller publishing world. You can approach mm-hmm. the publisher directly.
Mm-hmm.
I sent her some pages. She said, okay, send some more. I sent some more. She said, okay, send the whole book. I sent the whole book. She said, okay, we'd like to publish it. I was like, okay. We met. We spoke.
Yes.
And she was really kind. I admire Colleen Hicks very much.
Mm-hmm.
She's a real kind of force of nature with her publishing house. And so that was my experience of the first book. In terms of the reception, I was grateful. I was surprised, and I remain so. You know, I mean, I think it's important as a writer to also protect yourself. So when things like that happen, that's so wonderful, and it's great to appreciate it. But I think it's important to somehow manage, and obviously this is difficult, to keep that separate from your own writing project.
Well, it is invasive. The area of the world that is not in your control invades you and wants something from you.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's very strange.
And it works in both directions as well, is what I'm saying. I mean, there are people, you know, you have no control over what people like and don't like, and when they like it and when they don't like it. So for me, I'm grateful when it's positive. I might listen with a bit of an ear if it's constructive feedback.
Mm-hmm.
I try and not get too thwarted if it's negative or mean or, you know, hurtful.
Sure.
But try and stay, okay, but my job is to write, you know, over here.
Right.
And try and keep that true.
Okay, I have to ask.
Okay.
What did Mom and Dad think?
My dad, okay, so, and this is one of the sad things. So my mom had passed away by the time Bomb Boy came out. Yeah, so I actually dedicated it to her. My dad he's the proudest father imaginable. I'm so, you know, which is wonderful, actually, because he wanted what was best for me. So he wanted the career and the kind of the cash, you know.
Security.
Of
course.
But he, you know, when I worked it out and when the book came out, and he didn't really read any of it before. I didn't give it to him, rather, to read. He's just really happy for me. He's pleased. He reads my books. He buys a chunk of them and sends them to family and friends. And
very supportive. So we started to talk about a novel versus short story earlier. You have written a number of short stories, and they have been published.
Yeah.
So tell me about the difference and how you might approach. Well, I guess let's start with another question that relates to this. Do you have a strategy for the discipline of writing? In other words, some writers say, oh yeah, I get up at 8 every morning and I'm from 9 to 2, I'm just working away. And that's it, folks. I mean, do you have an outline for yourself?
I think that things like that are useful. I mean, I freelance as well. I do other freelance work. My life is, sometimes it's not easy for the length of 12 months to get one kind of regimen in, but I do think discipline is important, and I wrote
self-imposed,
absolutely. I wrote Bomb Boy part-time, and I'd kind of like paid for it. I'd maxed out my credit card to pay for it and all sorts of things. I thought, okay, I must finish, I can't take longer, and so I had great discipline, and I would write kind of, you know, 4 a.m. I'd write before work in the week.
Really? You started at 4 in the morning?
I would do it, and then, and I'd have to be religious about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I didn't have any other time. So that was kind of baptism of fire. It taught me to really just be disciplined and to be able to show up and produce.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to be focused to close out the rest of the world with all those other responsibilities.
Precisely. Yeah. And that was just because I was committed, because mm-hmm. I also didn't have more money. You know, it just had to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've kept that. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes it loosens a bit because life is a bit different for me now.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that that discipline is there. I know I have access to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it helps. It helps a lot. I think discipline's important.
Yeah, I agree. Mm-hmm. So back to short story versus novel.
Yes.
Do you approach those differently? Or are they...
I think I do. Novel, you know, I write, a novel is kind of 3 to 5 years. I mean, the one I'm working on now, 4 years. So I think that's mm-hmm. long. Some people say, oh, that's not that long. But
long.
I take my time mm-hmm. and I really, you know, sink into this text and the material I'm working with. And it kind of soaks, mm-hmm. you know, I let mm-hmm. it, and it's mm-hmm. a very meditative experience.
Mm-hmm. And do you enjoy the research part of it?
I do.
Yeah.
Often with short story, I conceptualize it almost fully and write it. My short stories are often kind of 5,000, 6,000 words. You know, they're not much longer.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they're even shorter than that. So mm-hmm. I can never get the novel in one kind of ball. Of course. So I have to just kind of meditate with it over years and mm-hmm. slowly,
mm-hmm.
you know, get it out. Mm-hmm. Whereas short story differently, but I find I'm more scared of short stories. Mm-hmm. I find them harder to do. Mm-hmm. I find them hard. I can start a bunch of short stories. I seldom finish them, you know, which is not my experience with novels. You know, if I start it, I'll complete it.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of respect for short story writers, people mm-hmm. who are like, that's their main, mm-hmm. the main form they work in.
Do you keep a journal?
On and off, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
And so with your novel, do you keep like a chart on the wall that sort of helps you track both the storyline and then all of the people and components mm-hmm. that go in and out
absolutely.
Of the story?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, after Bomboy, I didn't have that trick up my sleeve then, but I've learned in editing my uh-huh. second novel, I started using spreadsheets.
Spreadsheets. Okay.
Excel
good.
Spreadsheets, and those are that's a good thing, and it tracks the characters, it tracks the story, it tracks the timeline.
Mm-hmm.
I have a notebook. I have several notebooks for any one novel, and it's full of drawings and you know details mm-hmm. and bits of research strands, thoughts. I often record things because if I'm somewhere I don't have a notebook, so
mm-hmm.
and all of this you know is material that I would draw from when I sit down to write.
What about bad habits? What are some of your bad yeah. habits that might undermine your writing process?
Yes. Oh my goodness. It's good. But you know something, and this is not to sound funny, but I think creativity is such a great practice. There's something about it. If you're going to keep creating and stay well, because I think it's also mental wellness. It's unforgiving in that sense. So if you have bad habits, you either stop because the two can't coexist, or you learn to give that up. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like it's almost like it's a trainer. Like the creativity itself is a kind of a training. So I feel like often bad habits get trained out of me. So one bad habit, I think we have a lot of, is fear. Like. Well, the fear itself is not the bad habit, but listening to it,
mm-hmm.
doubt,
mm-hmm.
Bad talk. I think a lot of artists have this way, like imposter syndrome.
The bad talk you have with
yourself. Yeah, imposter syndrome. Yes. You're not really yes. that good. You cannot write. What right. are you doing? Right. My God, you're useless. Oh my God, that sentence is ridiculous. You know, that sort of, I mean, I think that's the worst habit any creative person can have.
Do you not feel that if you don't continue to have that dialogue in some form, you're not pushing yourself far enough, or you know, or going into enough unknown territory?
Yeah, I know what you mean. I think it's a fine line. I think there's a difference. I think doubt is useful.
Yes.
But what I'm talking about
is an irrational.
Voice. Not even irrational. There's an evil voice that's trying to just make you feel like nothing. I mean, doubt, I think, can be very robust.
Mm-hmm.
Can be like, are you
mm-hmm.
sure?
Mm-hmm.
Check. Check again. Wonder. Look harder. Check. Mm-hmm. You know, that's kind of light and beautiful, mm-hmm. you know, but mm-hmm. there's that voice that's saying you're useless. I mean, that's, mm-hmm. I don't think that, I mean, that might push you. And I had this conversation with a friend recently, this sense that creativity is suffering. You know, I mean, for me, that's something mm-hmm. I've had to make sure, because I want, like, wellness is important to me.
Mm-hmm.
Sense of wellness, a sense mm-hmm. of wholeness. in my own being, you know, and I want to create and have that. I don't want to create and kind of be crippled. And so I've tried to chart a course where there's a lightness, you know, and it's not significant, and I'm imperfect. I mean, I always say that my books are all imperfect. I know they are. And I don't think perfection is, I don't think that's the
goal.
I don't think that's the goal of creativity. Yeah.
So, but have you experienced depression around your work?
I mean, one never knows whether to call it depression with a capital D. And I don't know if it's only around my work, but I think I have experienced immense sadness. You know, I've experienced uncertainty, confusion, a sense of dislocation. Fear, and so I've had to really grapple with that, you know, and
do you see a pattern in yourself in how you approach working through that? I mean, a lot of people, I think, first of all, would sort of recluse themselves,
go quiet, retreat
a little bit. Other people might set aside the writing and read other writers for a while.
Yeah.
I mean, just wondering if you see in yourself patterns that help you work through it.
I think so, and I think what I'm good at is I can try things. Do you know what I mean? So I don't necessarily. So all the things you mentioned are things I would. So reading. I mean, reading is so important to me. Some people don't read while they're writing. I must read while I'm writing. Oh, I can't not read while I'm writing.
So you don't hear another voice that interferes with your voice.
I'm not worried about it. Ah. You know, I know people are like, oh, I'll steal it. And I'm not worried about it, and, you know, up till now it hasn't been an issue. So reading, I think being quiet, you mentioned journaling, paying attention, kind of just paying attention, feeling the feeling, you know, if it is this kind of immense, almost feeling it and knowing, like, you know, there's an end somewhere, it's not bottomless. All of those things are maybe kind of practices I've come through. Talking to people, you know, sometimes that's needed.
Who are you reading now?
Oh, I'm reading a number of things.
Is that also typical? Do you read many things at once?
It's actually only typical at this point in my writing. I feel like I'm getting, hopefully, near the end of what I'm working on. And so I'm doing research stuff. People mention books because they know what I'm... Oh, you should check this out. So I end up having this pool of stuff I'm moving back and forth between. But normally, I'm quite a sort of... you know, monogamous, like one book at a time. But at the most, I'm reading a book called Male Daughters, Female Husbands, which is, I'm writing in my new book about gender, motherhood. I'm writing about art and death. So I'm reading a number of things around those topics. I'm reading some John Berger, whom I really admire.
Such an amazing writer.
Yeah. So Ways of Seeing, I reread recently.
He's such an insightful writer about art too.
Yeah, that's.
I mean, he really gets it.
That's why I'm reading him.
So in 2013, you became a Norman Mailer Fellow. 2014, an
Etisalat.
Etisalat. Yes. Thank you, Fellow.
Yeah.
In 2015, a Miles Moreland Scholar. So please tell us about what it means to be a fellow and a scholar. How does that work for you in your life? And then, you know, what opportunities does it bring to you as a writer?
Yeah, these are all wonderful things, the things you named. And, you know, these are institutions, organizations, or sometimes linked to universities that support writers. You know, so something like Miles Moreland, it's a scholarship, what he does, his organization. It's based in London, and he, each year, I think 4 or 5 African authors, he gives these scholarships. They're very generous. It's for a full year, so you don't have to, you know, and it's enough that you don't have to do other work.
You don't have to go to London. You just stay where you are and
work. That's the other good part. You don't have to go anywhere.
Oh, what a gift.
So you stay where you are. You stay in your home, and you write your book. And it is, you know, and the agreement is, so you send a proposal through for a novel. So it is about novel, or maybe a short story collection. I'm not sure if that's allowed. I think it's novel, but they do fiction and nonfiction. And then...
Do you have to be recommended for this, or do you...
No, you apply.
Apply. Okay.
You apply. And it's gotten, so it's...
Wow, congratulations. That's such a great honor for you.
It was, I was thrilled and deeply grateful and remain so, you know, because it helped me immensely. And it was a critical year for me, and I got a lot of work done on the book I'm still working on now. just the security of that, you know. So Etisalat is a Pan-African prize. It's in its third or fourth edition this year, I think.
My goodness.
Yeah, and so again, Etisalat is a telephone company, as far as I know, and they are the sponsors. And so, yeah, this is about selecting the best debut novel in a certain time period. That was published on the continent of Africa that year. So
this was Bomboy?
So, well, Bomboy was shortlisted.
Okay.
And the kind of the happy ending to the story, there are three shortlisted authors, all really awesome people. And Bomboy was one of the shortlisted novels. The woman who won, Violet Bulawayo, for her book We Need New Names, there were two elements to the prize. There was a very generous cash prize, and then there was this fellowship at UEA, University of East Anglia, in Norwich. And Noviolet couldn't make the dates for the prize. I think that was part of it. Or she very generously kind of ceded that to what they called the runner-up, which happened to be me. So I was deeply grateful for her kindness. I'm sure she could have negotiated it and changed the dates or whatever, but she just said, you know what, it's fine. And so the next thing was to give it to me. So I got that opportunity, and, you know, I was in Norwich for about 3 months, I think, and again working just in a wonderful environment.
So let me ask you a more personal question. You don't have a family yourself.
I don't. I'm flying all over the world.
Well, I'm just wondering how you maintain this lifestyle. Because you do travel a lot, and you do residencies all over.
I don't have children. I don't have children. Okay.
So the second novel, The Woman Next Door, published in 2016, also got a lot of accolades. Sounds like a fascinating story. It's two women who live next door to each other. One's black, one's white.
Yeah.
They're kind of enemies.
Yes.
And then something happens in which they have a chance to sort of rethink how they've been treating each other and what their relationship is.
Yeah.
So where did that come from? And I'm curious whether you feel, either personally or culturally, that your work has to address racial concerns.
I mean, so where that came from actually was more just from meditating on what it is to be in your 80s. You know, both the characters are octogenarians, and I was around my grandmother who was living at the time, and my grandfather died, and I just kind of got to thinking, you know, wow, you know, this is a very distinct experience of life, and there's a way in which what gets privileged in image at the moment is youth. You know, or if it's age, it's imaged in a particular way. So just being around her got me thinking about what is that like, and I just started to speculate, and the story developed from there. You know, so it started more there, which maybe answers your question. I don't think it's kind of a duty of me or my creativity to address race or anything like that. But what I always respect is whatever the preoccupation is, you know, and what and how it morphs. And as I began to tell the story of these two, well, there was one old woman, then I thought, well, what is she, you know, who's her neighbor? And, you know, as the story sort of bubbled up, I thought, well, this is important for this story. I do think politics is everywhere, you know, and race is present, and gender, and these things are present. So kind of now I'm trying to write more about gender and the body and art. These are the things that I'm interested in as well.
So there's another quote here. Hating, after all, was a drier form of drowning.
Yeah.
Such a magnificent quote. That's from the book,
that's
I think,
from
right?
the book, yeah.
So let's elaborate on that.
Oh, goodness. Well,
I mean, it's one of those jewels of a phrase that captures so much.
Yeah. I think that part of that idea comes from what is it to resent? You know, and I suppose as the story developed and it's set in South Africa, and I'm dealing with women who are in their 80s, so I'm also then dealing with people who would have been growing up in the time of apartheid. And experienced it firsthand. And so we're looking at, we're now in the territory of forgiveness and reconciliation and what is truth. And we're in that territory. We're in the territory of pain, you know, and people who inflict pain and those who experience it, you know, and this is what we're grappling with, you know, in all over the world. But obviously, this is the country that I've lived in the most, and this is very difficult territory, you know, with human beings and with emotions. So I was looking at this thing of resentment, And the idea that resentment is I'll eat poison and watch you die. You know, but actually I'm the one with the poison. So which is this very common and popular idea, I think. I don't think it's particularly original, but the notion that it poisons you.
The hatred would eat you up.
The hatred, regardless of how justified it is.
Mm-hmm.
So now anger is useful. There's a paragraph in the book where the difference between what I think was resentment and anger. I mean, anger can be really productive. I think anger is important. But the resentment. So how do we heal properly? How do we mm-hmm. not get mm-hmm. stuck
mm-hmm.
with the one when we actually require the other?
Mm-hmm.
How do we hold people to account?
Mm-hmm.
How do we forgive?
Mm-hmm.
Can we reconcile? I mean, I think these are kind of the abiding mm-hmm. questions of humanity, but any country with the kind of past that South Africa has, definitely with a country like that.
Can we explore forgiveness for a second? This is something I've wondered about a lot, so I need your help.
Oh, okay.
So when I think about forgiveness, I think there's sometimes a little bit of a sort of a whitewash going on. And so what I'm interested in, why do we seek forgiveness when we can just have acceptance? In other words, so let's just use the common thing of someone hurts one of your family, a member of your family. And so I'm carrying around this resentment and hurt and anger, and yet I'm supposed to forgive them, and that's supposed to free me from my resentment and hurt and anger. But I'm sort of thinking, I hear a false note in that. So I'm saying, what's wrong with still getting to be angry? But why not just move through it through accepting this is what happened.
It happened,
It is an awful thing. There is no forgiveness. It is an awful thing what that person did. But I accept it, and now I need to move on to take care of myself as well. How do you feel about that?
I mean, I firstly think that even though the example is useful, I do think there's something about this that, while it's important that we have examples and we look, you know, we kind of speculate about it, it's also something that it's important that it's lived. I think if it's lived, you can speak from a different place. So the minute when you were asking me that question, and I don't, you might have your own examples, I was just thinking of what are the things, you know, what are the things that maybe have been done to me or my family? Who are the people I haven't forgiven or ought to? Or I was trying to find my lived experience, because I think that has its own kind of wisdom, distinct from the speculation, looking in and kind of speculating, which has its place as well. So when you ask that without going into any details, I mean, I think you're right, because you introduce something important, this idea of acceptance. And I think you're right to say forgiveness, we can become glib.
Mm-hmm.
Forgiveness becomes this, and there are ways in which we fell into that trap in South Africa with the TRC, with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And it was important and necessary, but it's not the whole picture. You know, something was missed, and maybe that's what you're saying. You're like, well, this is not the complete thing. It's not kind of forgiveness done.
Yes, it seems like a package deal that was like, oh, I just have to sign the forgiveness line.
Exactly.
Yeah. Like, No.
It isn't that. And also that it is one directional.
Yes.
You know, also that it is. I mean, these are falsehoods. This is not true to life. And I hope that's partly what I wanted to try and pick away at in The Woman Next Door. But I mean, I would definitely agree with you in being skeptical. And I knew that the story couldn't just be kind of a happy, happy, we're friends, everything's fine now story, because that's not really the case.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's much more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more back and forth than that. It's harder than that, actually. Mm-hmm. And we never want to know that things are harder, but it's harder than that.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have an answer, though. I don't know that anyone does.
Mm-hmm. So, do you see this book becoming a movie? I know it's a funny question, but I'm just seeing all these visuals of these two women working through the stuff of life. It seems to have a lot of content.
Well, that would be a lot of fun, but I mean, I don't think I have to see it becoming a movie. I think some, you know, massive TV producer has to see it become a movie. Producer has to see it becoming a movie. At the same time, I mean, I think there is something, as you say, visual about the way the story plays out. And I mean, you know, and so Who knows?
Mm-hmm. I'll say. Do you think of yourself as an intuitive writer?
I mean, yeah. I won't always use that word, but I think that's a... I see it as I do like the gut, and I just what comes up from the unconscious and what bubbles forward, and I just kind of go with it and trust. And but it's scary because I'm thinking, this is ridiculous, and you don't know what you're doing. You know, what do you, like, this makes no sense, but keep going.
Keep going.
And I think I am that kind of writer, and also not too precious. Not too precious until being precious matters. Mm-hmm. And I think being precious matters
at the end.
At the end. You know, sure. But when it's bubbling forward, it's a lot of permission and allowance.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of, that's always how I've written with Bomboy all the way through. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So as you look out on the sort of the literary landscape, I'm curious who comes up as people that you admire, you find inspiration.
Yeah.
I'm very curious to know how you feel about Claudia Rankine's work.
Okay.
But other people, yeah, too. I mean, you know, especially outside of America, I'd be very curious more of an international view.
Yeah. I mean, there are so many writers. Writers like Toni Morrison is mm-hmm. a writer that I was reading in high school and was just deeply inspired by her and have remained so. A writer like, there's a young writer, Helen Oyeyemi, whom I admire deeply. There's a writer called Marie Ndiaye, whose father is Cameroonian, I think, but she's Parisian.
Mm-hmm.
She wrote a book called Three Strong Women, which is a book I really... it's just, for me, the writers that I find myself going back to and admiring are writers who I think are trying to do something. I mean, that sounds kind of general, but I read it and think, it's the trying. They don't have to have succeeded. But I just admire that they're trying. It gives me
mm-hmm.
permission to try as well and mm-hmm. to, you know, make mistakes, you know, as they say, what fail better. I mean, you know, that idea of,
mm-hmm.
and that's exciting for me. It's an exciting energy. There are many writers, I'm just thinking who else have, Claudia Rankine I actually haven't read, I must confess.
That's right.
But a writer was talking to me about her here. I've obviously heard of her.
Sure. Well, it's hard to know where to start with her because so many of her things are great. But reading Citizen, would start with Citizen.
Okay.
But I would also read The Racial Imaginary.
Oh, really?
Which I think is really a groundbreaking, important collection of works by many writers who have some really intelligent and thoughtful insights onto race in America.
Wow.
And I'm learning a lot, I feel, from it.
Incredible.
She won the MacArthur Fellowship, and then with that money, she started The Racial Imaginary.
Okay.
And she is, I am so impressed with her.
Oh, wow. Well, I'm going to take that on. Yeah. I mean, there's just so many, and they're incredible. Sure. You know, there's even writers like Amata Aidu, who's a Ghanaian writer, that I have a lot of respect for, Buchi Emetita, who passed away earlier this year. Mm. You know, writers that have also kind of laid the ground in a way, it feels like. Mm.
And what about poetry?
Yes. Now, poetry, I always have this feeling, I feel illiterate, you know, when it comes to poetry.
Really?
Well, in the sense that I was at a festival recently and there were some poets there, just incredible poets, and I said to one of them, I don't always read poetry. I love to hear it. I always feel it ought to be heard, like it's music, you know. Because you could read, I've studied a bit of music, so you could read music, you know, treble, clef, and so on. That's fine. But you could listen to it. And I feel that way about poetry, but I need to sort of get over that. Because I buy poetry, I do read poetry, but I always feel as if it's a translation. I'm getting an instruction versus the, mm-hmm. do you know what I mean?
Sure. And so you have, so far, not attempted to write poetry.
Oh, no. I mean, unfortunately, I have. Unfortunately, I have attempted to write poetry. I do write poetry. I mean, very little of it gets out into the public place, but I do write. So less so these days, I would say. Mm-hmm. When I was in high school, when I was in university, I wrote a lot more.
Do you sing?
I do sing.
I would guess you have a great singing voice.
Okay. Oh, that's nice. Thank you. I was in a band. I do need to do my shout out to my university band.
How wonderful.
We did end. I think that was a good thing. But we had a band. Most of us were architects. And we started this band.
And you called yourself The Singing Buildings?
Oh, my God. We should have. We needed you around. We struggled with names. We moved around a bit. And we ended up on The Extensions.
Oh, that's good. There's a local writer here in the Hudson Valley. Dee Collin is her name.
Okay.
And she was on the program a month ago.
Yeah.
And she's a school teacher.
Okay.
But she's a wonderful poet. And she sings part of her poetry.
Wow.
So I was sitting here looking at you thinking, oh, I could hear you, I could just envision seeing you sing part of what you're writing.
Wow, wow.
And that would feel like like it was true to you in some way. I mean, it's total speculation.
But no, that's so funny, because in Bomboy, part of the story is a strand of folklore, Yoruba folklore, that I include, and it's in Yoruba, and I include it in the book throughout, and it's a song. So if I did, sometimes if I felt brave, when I did readings, I would read where the song was and break into song in the middle of the reading.
See, I can see that.
So you're not far off.
I can see that. So as you look around you, the world today, many of us feel like the world's in a mess.
Mm.
What's your take on things? What concerns you? What are you watching?
I think that anger is useful. So you can look and there is a lot that's a mess. Sometimes it's like most of it's a mess. I mean, exactly. And when you have, you know, particularly I have allegiance to so many countries, and if it's Nigeria or South Africa, and we're dealing with kind of dark times, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So anger is useful, you know, action is useful, because you can look and assess and think, oh, but I think action is important and anger is important.
Anger is a motivating capability into action that will make things better.
It is. Organizing is also important.
Mm-hmm.
Strategy.
Mm-hmm.
I really love this article that Toni Morrison wrote, actually, and I think it came out in The Nation, and it was published probably just after Trump was elected, and she was talking about how she was talking back to days when, like, Bush was re-elected, Bush Jr., and how she woke up that morning and she was so kind of down, and her friend called and said, how? And she's like, oh, you know, and the friend was like, what's wrong? And she just said, you know, I don't know what. And the friend was like, no, you're a writer. This is the time. This is not the time to be, you know, get to work. Go get, you know, hit the computer, hit the pages. And I love that. You know, there's a professor whom I really respect in South Africa. Her name is Pumla Kola. And she has this great phrase where she says, women who riot, women who write, you know, and I think this is important. This is,
mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that's always the response, but there is a sense that this is a time to be active. This is a time to act, whatever you're doing, whatever you want to do. You could sing, you could,
mm-hmm.
but whatever you are doing, it's a time to act.
It's fertile territory.
Yeah. And it's also important to remember, we've seen these people before. You know, it's not like they suddenly came out of nothing, and we can survive them. We must organize. We must connect. We must talk to each other. But they come. They do great damage. But they can also leave. They do leave.
And we can repair.
So yeah. So it's just to kind of keep our heads
mm-hmm.
Is important. And I think for that, community is needed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know if I think of just me, I mm-hmm. feel deeply incapable. You know, that's depressing. I think, I don't know anything. But if I think of community, if I think of people I can organize with, people mm-hmm. that I think are really intelligent and have, then I have a sense of hope, you know?
So, where are you going to be in 5 years? Where do you want to be in 5 years?
Where do I want to be in 5 years? Wow. Somewhere warm, hopefully. I was born on an island, I always say, somewhere warm. And somewhere, you know, with people I love. I mean, I think I almost don't matter where I am. I think that's important. More and more, maybe the older I get, those things seem important. I mean, you asked about family. I think I'd like family, whatever form it takes. You know, mm-hmm. I think I would love to be in a unit, you know,
mm-hmm.
and doing things with that. You know, I'm writing about family in the book I'm working on, and it's a project. It's a certain kind of a project, family.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's an important project. You know, it's a project that involves love and negotiation and conversation. And, you know, it's a nice kind of microcosm for the things that we need to be good at anyway. So I'm interested in that, yeah.
Do you have something to read?
I wondered if you wanted that. And I could read from The Woman Next Door or read from the woman next door.
Whatever you like. We'd love to hear something from you.
I mean, I could go and get something. I could either get the book, because I have a copy of it, or I could get something from what I'm working on.
Okay, let's go pick something. We'll be right back.
So I'm reading from a book I'm working on currently, and I've been working on for some years. The book is, at the moment, called Sleeping, Not Dreaming. And it's the story of a family that fails, in a way, and then has a second chance. So it's a story of a husband and wife that get divorced, and an adult daughter that sort of removes herself from the lives of her parents. So this kind of, this family is just kind of
dispersed.
And there's something that happens, and the parents come together, attempt to reconcile, and go in search of their daughter who's now missing from them. And that's kind of the basic conceit of the story. But the story is really about the family. So we meet them from, you know, we meet them from when they start, and we work with them through as they're dealing with what they're dealing with.
Okay. And you said to me, this is a work in progress.
It's a work in progress.
This could totally change.
It could change, including the title. I've learned now that titles change. I'm reading from a part of the story that is focusing more on the mother. Her name at the moment is Mary Louise. The family is Nigerian. And this is about her experience of becoming a mother, or the times around becoming a mother. The day Mary Louise found out she was pregnant, the things she immediately thought of were her biology classes with Miss Daxon, the textbooks with pictures that looked unfamiliar no matter which way she held the book, how far or close the page was from her nose. It surprised her that she was pregnant, the kind of surprise she could not admit to her husband. Why should she have been surprised? There hadn't been anything specially called sexual education, but there had been those biology lessons. Mary Louise had grown up and liked boys, kissed none, met Titus and married him. And as a married couple, they'd been regularly copulating. That she was pregnant was a mere feature of natural science. And yet she was surprised. Not even because she'd been using pills to stop a pregnancy, or her rhythms, or his withdrawal to hinder nature. They hadn't discussed having a child, but neither had they discussed not. She a virgin, Titus with his dubiously proclaimed authority on lovemaking, they had explored themselves and each other with a curiosity set loose by the legitimacy of a priest in a medium-sized Methodist church bestowed on them, man and wife. Nothing prepared Mary Louise for motherhood. She was 26, her mother was dead, and her father laconic. Titus had been raised by a nun, a woman he referred to as sister, who, by the time of their marriage, was barely able to walk the short distance from the church door to her spot on the pew. There was an aunt, whom Mary Louise did not know well, her mother's sister. She showed up when the belly was big and said an assortment of contradictory things depending on the time of day, how much gin she drank, how convivial she felt. "It's hard," she would say. "It's frightening. It's natural. It's normal. It's not normal. It's easy. It's the original love. Men don't know. Men can't know." Sometimes Auntie Modupe said nothing. Mary Louise was still working her job at the Capital Projects Unit with Jones, but feeling each day that she couldn't really cope. She got headaches, her bladder wouldn't cooperate, and each day she marveled that she didn't just dissolve and sink through her water-laden feet. She stopped working to wait out the final months. Titus grumbled, but Auntie Modupe stayed on. She went to the market on days she felt enterprising and came back with dark green leaves, prepared them, said, "Drink." She squeezed Mary Louise's hand, winked, smiled, cried, prayed. Auntie Modupe prayed for a quick birth, a clean cut, a steady push, much breath. She prayed for a whole child, an easy child, a good sleeper, a good eater. She asked for beauty. She asked for a boy. Sometimes she asked for a girl. Sometimes she asked Mary Louise, "Well, which do you want?" Mary Louise did not respond, stunned as she was that anything was coming at all. There she was with a pregnancy that had been neither planned nor unplanned. A pregnancy that made sense to her husband. He was happy. "At last," he'd said, and kissed her hand. The pregnancy made sense to science, but not to Mary Louise. And even her surprise was a surprise. It was a moment where she saw her naivete, her capacity to live in an unreal world. Something similar to living in a world, your own place, where you decided there was no such thing as gravity. In Mary Louise's world, her aversion to children should have been contraception enough. In fact, after 2 years of marriage and nothing, she'd convinced herself that she was unable to have any. And yet, January 1976, dawn time of a Friday, a pain hit, but not only pain, also a sensation they have not yet named. A thing that wakes all the senses, the sinews, all the jelly in the body, wakes it up and says, let's go.
How wonderful.
Thank you.
So I have a question about style.
Okay.
Because I've only heard you read twice.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I haven't read your books yet, but I will.
Fine.
But you write in very short sentences, and it creates a rhythm and a dynamic.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, is that typical for the rest of your work? Is that, or is that a conscious decision?
I think it's conscious posts. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm seeing that now. It's funny you mention it now.
Yeah.
Because I'm sort of looking and seeing that and thinking, okay. And I you know, rhythm is important to me.
It's very important.
Yeah.
And so, I'm partly curious, just yes. because I like the process of creating.
Yes.
So, do they start out much longer sentences?
Oh,
and
no,
you pare it down,
they don't.
Or is
it
just pretty true to how that came out?
It does come out, yeah. It does come like out that way.
Because
yeah.
it has a beat. You know, it's
yeah.
very musical.
Yeah, maybe that's, and I think that's,
oh, yeah.
It's important to, I mean, now I can know that and understand how to work with that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's, I mean, it'd be interesting to go back to Bomboy, because I actually don't know now. To go back to Bomboy and see whether it's present there.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's present in The Woman Next Door
mm-hmm.
to some degree. Mm-hmm.
And then I have another writer question.
Okay.
Do you feel any affinity with Virginia Woolf? And I'll tell you why I asked that.
Okay, I'm curious. Please tell me why.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Virginia Woolf, to me, one of, you know, all writers have elements in their work that runs through pretty their body of work.
Yeah.
And it seems to me, and I actually read this somewhere.
Mm.
I'm sorry, I can't remember who said it, but one of the things that she was preoccupied with was capturing the six things that everyone feels every second and trying to distribute them through language. And if you read her with this, you know, she has an incredible sense of detail.
Yeah, she does.
And her work is very intimate and immediate.
Yes, yes.
And you could almost say it's about nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet
yeah.
it's about everything.
Yeah.
Your work,
yeah.
as little as I know it, does concern itself
yeah.
with these details.
Mm.
But you also have this wonderful ability to narrate a deeper private sense
yeah.
person in
yeah.
there.
Yeah, yeah. This is, I mean, so she's, and she's someone also I read when I started reading when I was younger as
mm-hmm.
well, and was influential.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously her fictional work, but also like A Room of One's Own. And
mm-hmm. sure.
So it's interesting you say that, and I've never thought of that, you know, you now maybe want to kind of go back and look at her work again.
Mm-hmm.
But now when you say it, you remind me of a friend who said to me that that she felt that there was some sort of echo, you know.
Really?
There, and I thought, oh, okay, that's interesting.
Yeah.
It's not conscious. It's not.
Right.
I mean, I don't have her next to me. Like, I don't have a conscious sense.
Mm-hmm.
Toni Morrison is somebody I always feel like consciously I have her rhythms, you know, in my head.
Mm-hmm.
And Virginia Woolf less so. But now that you talk about it.
So are you interested in absurdity? Because you sort of capture the amazing, like, just like, I don't know how to say it, this sort of absurdity of life in a big way.
Yeah.
But not in the minute way. Not in the ridiculous.
Okay. I'm just thinking of an example. So would you say an example of it in a minute way would be what? What sort of?
Gertrude Stein would be an easy
okay.
one.
Okay,
so,
okay.
So, you know, where the work is...
Yeah.
Bizarre
yes,
sometimes.
Yes, yes, right down to the detail.
But
yeah.
there is this interesting integrated marriage of things that do come together,
yeah.
like in Tender Buttons is
yes,
an example,
yeah,
right?
Okay. Yeah.
And of course, some of the surrealist poets could
mm.
be examples too.
Mm-hmm.
I like Robert Desnos is a good example.
Okay.
And he'll write, you know,
yeah.
It,
yeah, yeah,
there'll
yeah.
be an absurdity or, you know, and it's
yeah.
an imaginative
yes,
absurdity.
Yes, yes.
But it's not concrete, you
yeah.
know, it's not holding you to the ground. It's
yeah.
floating.
Yeah.
Your work is very held to the ground.
Okay, I see what
is
you
that,
mean.
Is that a fair
yeah,
analysis?
Yeah, it is. And I mean, I also think sometimes you're working your way towards something. And I have great admiration for that kind of absurdity. You know, and I feel like I'm learning how to... you know, you're always wielding so many things as you're trying
mm-hmm.
to write the novel. And style is there, but there's also a story you're trying to tell. And so... I find it appealing, and I think I have some ambition towards that,
mm-hmm.
and maybe I'll get there. There's a book I read recently called Tram 83 by Fiston Mujila. He's a young writer. He's a poet.
Mm-hmm.
This is his first book.
And the title again?
It's called Tram 83.
Tram 83.
I really recommend it, and I admired it so much. It's set in Cameroon. I think it is, but it's a fictitious town. I mean, and it's thoroughly absurd, you know, and it's also fabulous, and, you know, mm-hmm. and I sort of read it, and your heart's beating all the way through, and it's a slender book, and I admire him so much, and in a way, I think we need that. What's so wonderful about the absurd is it breaks the glass, you know, and the not preciousness. Mm-hmm. So it appeals to me. I don't know that I'm quite there in my imagination.
Well, or even if it's an interest to you, but I mean,
yeah,
I'm
it's
just
of
curious.
Interest. I haven't, you know, whatever. My material at the moment isn't that, but I have a sense that I'll write something like that at some point, or maybe in short story form, because it's maybe more manageable. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Well, Yuani, this has been a true pleasure.
Thank you
very much.
It's so
great to
I
be
really
with you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
I really do.